The Conservatives also became the party of defence. In 1878, when the Russians were at war with Turkey and our interests were threatened, the popular song was coined.
We don't want to fight, but by jingo if we do, we've got the ships, we've got the men, we've got the money too.
Patriotism and defence are closely allied. This was the golden age of imperialism and of great pride in an expanding empire upon which the sun never set. The Primrose League was formed in 1883 after Disraeli's death, taking as its symbol Disraeli's favourite flower. By 1891, there were over 1 million members. The League, with its picturesque medieval names, emphasised colour, ritual and romance. It was dedicated to the maintenance of religion, the estates of the realm, and the imperial ascendancy of the British Empire. Towards the end of the 19th century, the Conservatives passed a whole series of acts to enhance the condition of the people, dealing with health, employment, housing, education, and even allotments. No wonder Alexander Macdonald, the miners' leader, could say in 1879,
"The Conservative Party has done more for the working classes in 5 years than the Liberals in 50.
Soon the Conservatives were reinforced by a new group, the Liberal Unionists, led by Joseph Chamberlain, who objected to the Irish Home Rule policy of Gladstone. Eventually, in 1896, they joined the Conservative government. The Conservative Party was, by 1914, ceasing to be the party of the landed interest and was embracing all classes. Nonconformist manufacturers and Wesleyan working men and mill managers were becoming common among its members, as well as the traditional Anglicans. It was in the First World War that another great Conservative leader became well known to the public. Winston Churchill, who had been a distinguished First Lord of the Admiralty, became Secretary of State for War in the 1918 government. There, in his efforts to reverse the Bolshevik Revolution, he became aware of the great threat this posed to the free world, and he developed an implacable hatred towards all forms of socialism. The Conservative Party was now facing a new enemy, the Marxists, with their mechanistic, atheistic view of human nature, allied at home with a growing sector of the Labour Party, which was now replacing the Liberals as the second party. In 1922, the Carlton Club meeting of Conservative MPs and peers brought to an end the post-war coalition and restored an exclusively Conservative government. This led to the formation of the 1922 Committee, a weekly meeting of backbench Conservative MPs, at which, from time to time, issues of great importance are discussed. It is a private forum which can ventilate issues without threatening the traditional loyalties of Conservatives, which are, in the last resort, to the party and not to any individual. Stanley Baldwin, who was Prime Minister in 1923, Prime Minister again from 1924 to 1929, and finally leader of the national government, first as Lord President and then as Prime Minister, was, like Mr. Churchill, implacably opposed to communism.
"No gospel founded on hate will ever seize the hearts of our people, the people of Great Britain. It is no good trying to cure the world by spreading out oceans of bloodshed."
Baldwin and successive Conservative leaders opposed both fascism and communism as inhuman creeds and attempted to train the Labour Party in the art of responsible and limited government. Baldwin firmly opposed the general strike of 1926.
"Constitutional government is being attacked. The general strike is a challenge to Parliament and is the road to ruin."
Yet after the strike was defeated, he used all his influence to dissipate subsequent bitterness. His aim was to stamp a moderate and responsible conservatism on the party. In the 1930s, the Conservatives had to meet the triple challenge of an economic crisis, subsequent unemployment, and the threat from Hitler and Mussolini. It was not an easy time. The Wall Street crash of 1929 led to grave economic troubles, and in 1931 the national government was formed of men of goodwill. Significantly, only the socialists refused to join. Britain, after the losses of the 1914-18 war, was also in a pacifist mood. The majority of Liberal and Labour MPs opposed rearmament and would have left us defenceless in the approaching war. Again, there are parallels with today. Neville Chamberlain, Prime Minister from 1937, had a splendid record, both as a social reformer and as an administrator. Following Baldwin, he did all that he believed he could in the climate of his times to increase our defences. The weakness of Neville Chamberlain was that he considered Hitler and Mussolini as reliable in their words and promises as Birmingham businessmen. The fall of Chamberlain in 1940 brought Winston Churchill as Prime Minister in a coalition government. He, with something of the romanticism of Disraeli and the toughness of a prize fighter, stood head and shoulders over his generation. He was a born leader, master of the English language, historian, writer, orator, visionary and inspired personality. For 5 years, Churchill led a united parliament and people through the dark days of war and fulfilled the Tory philosopher Burke's idea of parliament as being not a congress of our ambassadors with hostile and different interests, but a deliberative assembly of one nation with one interest, that of the whole. Those who lived through the Second World War will never forget Churchill's rousing exhortations, his call after Dunkirk.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
To paraphrase his own words, the British people might be the lion, but he gave the roar. The history of the Second World War could well have been different without his inspired leadership. In the 1945 election, Churchill warned the country against socialism, in words then thought to be exaggerated, but which since have proved to be prophetically true in all fields.
There can be no doubt that socialism is inseparably interwoven with totalitarianism and the subject worship of the state. Socialism is in its essence an attack not only on British enterprise, but on the right of any ordinary man or woman to breathe freely without a harsh, clammy, tyrannical hand clapped across their mouths and nostrils.
Churchill clearly defined the Conservatives' new enemies as socialism and communism. He once said that the vice of capitalism is the unequal sharing of blessings, and the virtue of socialism is the equal sharing of misery. The party thus moved to defend not only individual freedom, but free enterprise and low taxation, and the property rights without which political liberty will die. It was Churchill, too, who said in 1946, "An iron curtain has descended across the continent." He also had a vision of a United States of Europe, but still in close alliance with the United States of America. The period of Labour government from 1945 to 1951 was used by the Conservatives for a reconsideration of Conservative policy under R.A. Butler and for the notable reorganisation and streamlining of the party's machine by Lord Woolton. Membership of the party rose to 2.5 million people in 1948. All this paved the way for 13 years of Conservative rule, 1951 to 1964, which began with a Churchillian dash for freedom. The nationalisation of the Suez Canal by Nasser in July 1956 led to military intervention against Egypt by France, Israel and Britain, now under the leadership of Sir Anthony Eden, who had 3 times been Foreign Secretary, a record unequalled this century. The Daily Telegraph exclaimed,
"How good it is to hear the British lion roar."
The invasion failed due to lack of American financial and moral support, and so the twilight of the empire became more dim. Harold Macmillan, Prime Minister after Suez, the grandson of a crofter and the son-in-law of a duke, had an Edwardian air which belied an astute intelligence and a deep compassion. He completed the steps begun by Baldwin in the 1930s for the end of the Conservatives as the party of empire. The end of the British Raj in 1947 had already changed the power balance of the world. Macmillan's premiership, however, coincided with considerable British prosperity. The 1959 Conservative Manifesto offered to double the British standard of living in a generation. It was concern over the level of prosperity which led to the much-quoted expression of never had it so good. But this must be seen in context. What Macmillan said in Bedford in 1957 was,
"Let's be frank about it. Most of our people have never had it so good. Go around the country, go to the industrial towns, go to the farms, and you will see a state of prosperity such as we have never had in my lifetime, nor indeed in the history of this country. But what is beginning to worry some of us is it too good to be true? Or perhaps I should say, is it too good to last?"
Yet the Labour Party lost the 1959 election because of the rising living standards which took large numbers of manual workers into the ranks of the middle classes, and they found the philosophy of conservative expansion preferable to the class war and egalitarianism. The pity is that if the Conservatives had also won the 1964 election, they would probably have destroyed the Labour Party as a socialist party and made it a social democratic party as in Germany. The end of the British Empire and the declining British power meant that Britain had to look for a new power base, and Conservatives saw this within the vision of Churchill as a United Europe alliance with the United States of America. Mr. Heath, as Lord Privy Seal in 1960, under Mr. Macmillan's leadership, was largely responsible for the negotiations to join the European Economic Community. In August 1961, 47 years after the outbreak of the First World War, the House of Commons resolved to make a formal application to join the European Economic Community. The decision was in the grand line of British policy from Tudor times onward, the maintenance of the balance of power in Europe. General de Gaulle, however, blocked our application, and Mr. Heath and the Conservative Party continued to wait for an opportunity to take us into the common market. The 13 years of Conservative rule, which came to an end in 1964, was the longest continuous period of one party in government since the Tory defeat of 1830. With only 14 seats less than Labour, Sir Alec Douglas-Hume, whose loyalty and integrity are admired by all, after only 1 year as party leader and Prime Minister, almost achieved a fourth victory in 1964. A year later, in July 1965, Edward Heath was elected by the Conservative MPs as their leader on the resignation of Sir Alec. This was the first time that the leader of the party was elected by a secret ballot of Conservative members of Parliament. The Conservatives, under Mr. Heath, won the 1970 general election against all odds and expectations. The Selsdon Manifesto promised a return to more free enterprise, lower taxation, and less government intervention. After 6 years of rampaging socialism, this seemed to catch the public mood. After 1 year, however, the 1970-74 Conservative government moved back to more government intervention and a prices and incomes policy. It would seem that the Conservative policy debate was not now about free trade on an international plane, but the degree of government intervention at home. The 1970-74 Conservative government will be remembered for the entry into the European Economic Community, the Housing Finance Act, and the Industrial Relations Act. The first is historic, while the second and third were repealed by the subsequent Labour government, which is itself an indication of how far consensus and continuity has broken down in British politics. After the two electoral defeats in February and October of 1974, Mrs. Margaret Thatcher was elected by the Conservative members of Parliament as their new leader in early 1975. Once again, the Conservative Party scored a first. Her speeches have indicated a full realization of the threat to freedom, initiative, and political liberty, which arises from socialism and a Labour Party moving rapidly to the left. She is fully aware of Solzhenitsyn's prophecy of doom, which threatens us all, and the need for self-help and drive at home and external defence abroad. At the Blackpool Conference of 1975, in words that Winston Churchill would have been proud to use, Mrs. Thatcher said,
"It's the Labour government that brought the level of production below that of the three-day week in 1974. We've really got a three-day week now, only it takes 5 days to do it."
On education, she said,
"Others under the shelter of our education system are ruthlessly attacking the minds of the young. Everyone who believes in freedom must be appalled at the tactics employed by the far left in the systematic destruction of the North London Polytechnic. Latent tactics of intimidation designed to undermine the fundamental beliefs and values of every student. Tactics pursued by people who are the first to insist on their own civil rights while seeking to deny them to the rest of us."
Then, talking about our past, she commented,
"Well, what kind of people are we? We're the people that in the past made Great Britain the workshop of the world. The people who persuaded others to buy British, not by begging them to do so, but because it was best. We're a people who received more Nobel Prizes than any other nation except America. And head for head, we've done better than America. Twice as well, in fact. We're the people who, among other things, invented the computer, the refrigerator, the electric motor, the stethoscope, rayon, steam turbine, stainless steel, the tank, television, penicillin, radar, the jet engine, hovercraft, float glass and carbon fibers, etc. Oh, and the best half of Concord." "We export more of what we produce than either West Germany, France, Japan, or the United States. And well over 90% of these exports come from private enterprise."
And in her famous January 1976 speech on defence, which caused the Russians to give her the title of the Iron Lady, she said of the socialists,
"They don't seem to realise that the submarines and missiles that the Russians are building could be destined to be used against us. Perhaps some people in the Labour Party think we're on the same side as the Russians. But just let's have a look at what the Russians are actually doing. She's ruled by a dictatorship of patient, far-sighted, determined men who are rapidly making their country the foremost naval and military power in the world."
The future of the Conservative Party depends on three factors: its ability to give faith, pride and patriotism back to our nation, its ability to bring back economic prosperity to our country, and thirdly, its continued ability to absorb new groups and individuals into its midst. There is every indication that the Conservative Party will reduce the crippling government intervention into our lives and lessen taxation, and by providing incentives to workers, managers and investors, bring back prosperity again. Our people do not, however, live by bread alone. People desire purpose and identity. The British Empire once gave it to them. The defence of Britain, Europe and the free world could bring back purpose again. This link with greater emphasis on standards in education, law and order in our streets, and the ending of abuses and excesses of the welfare state, and the stress on the unity of our people, could win recruits from all classes, particularly the working classes. The Conservative Party has always absorbed men of vision and goodwill, from Disraeli to Winston Churchill, who returned from the Liberals, even to Lord Wilton, who was once a Fabian. The working man, the self-employed, the lovers of freedom from all backgrounds must be welcomed into the party and encouraged to play their part. Time and again, the Conservative Party has risen rebaptized in a new age, and it will do so again. Its mission is not like that of the Labour Party, to pretend to know more than our people, but it is to legitimize the instincts of the men and women in the street again. They are there waiting for a proud and understanding banner to walk behind. That is the banner of the Conservative Party, proud heir of the Tory Party, whose history is the history of our country, and whose future will also decide our country's future.